Wherever you are in West Texas, whether in Lubbock or in Abilene or at your home base here in Wichita Falls, we thank you today for listening. This program is about the culture of America. It's not simply about politics, even though it touches politics, it touches religion, but it is about culture, the culture of America. What is a culture, by the way? A culture comes from the word cult, which refers to or has reference to a religious presupposition, religious concepts. You know, civilizations are based upon religious presuppositions. I know that many people don't prefer that. Many people don't like that, but that's the very concept of a culture. So today we're talking about the American culture, and we have a lot of interesting things right now in the news. I want to talk about American oligarchy. We'll talk about that in a moment, because we're also talking about the Constitution, and we have some things about the Constitution to say. Then we also have some things about general welfare versus welfare. General welfare is a welfare or general welfare statement in the Constitution versus welfare. And then also, have you heard about the World Happiness Council? I hope Mike, who is across the desk from me, has heard about the World Happiness Council, because that will make you very happy that there have legislators going to make you happy that way at the world body.
Why do I have a feeling that something called the World Happiness Council is only going to make me mad?
That's true. And then at the last, I want to talk about what I have some, really what I might call some quick notes, just talk about some of the issues that are going on. So let's look at American, what I call American oligarchy. Now, I use the word oligarchy not advisedly. I use it just openly, because that's exactly the word Thomas Jefferson used when referring to this particular problem that we have in America right now. Oligarchy, first of all, means a ruling or a governing powers that are in the hands of a few people. That's all that oligarchy means. However, it always carries with it, almost always carries with it, the idea of despotic powers, that is, heavy-handed, too heavy-handed, despotic rule, instead of a we the people system. Our country was fashioned, as the Constitution begins, we the people. Our Charter of Liberty, the Constitution, organizes everything from the bottom up. That is, the power was to remain, and the power plant was to remain with the people, in order that we might oversee our own freedom, that we might be able to maintain the freedom that God gave us. And that's the way the founders would put it. And in order to maintain it, we have servants. And those servants are in the government, that is, the representatives of government. So, 230 years later, after the founding of the United States, the founding of our nation, Americans find themselves, all of us find ourselves, in a top-down federal oligarchy that is called the Supreme Court, in which every law, every expression of freedom might be negated as unconstitutional. Now, we could take a couple of tacks at this point. We can go back and trace, or try to trace, some of the areas in which we have departed, but I don't want to do that right now. I want simply to look at how we have, indeed, a despotic monstrosity in the Supreme Court, because we want to see regarding the Constitution. Let's think for just a moment, setting the boundaries of the issue here. President Thomas Jefferson, perhaps most people are familiar with, was in a dispute with Chief Justice, the fourth Chief Justice, I believe, of the Supreme Court, John Marshall. And this is something that Jefferson wrote to him, quote, "You seem to consider judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions, a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under control, or under the despotism, rather, of an oligarchy." That was Thomas Jefferson. He said that if the judges are going to control it, if they're going to be the final arbiters of what is constitutional and what is not, then we have a despotism or a despotic government and an oligarchy, a rulership of just a few. That is precisely where we are in America. Let's just take, for example, we'll come back to it in a few moments, the travel ban that President Trump imposed, or that President Trump signed. We have federal judges at district levels telling us that that ban is unconstitutional, even though the United States Code is very clear that the president has that authority. How does it come about that a group of two or three judges, just that's all we had in San Francisco, I think that's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, we only had two or three judges that actually made some kind of what they called a ruling on it and barred Trump's travel ban from coming into place. Now, recently, the Supreme Court ruled that it was not unconstitutional, or at least most parts of it, so it was kind of a win. But the point that we're driving towards is, where in the world did we get the idea that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter, as Jefferson put it, of all constitutional questions? President Thomas Jefferson was not a prophet, but as well as all the founders of that generation, they understood perfectly well what it is that consists of the nature of man, what we need to have liberty, and the constructs that are necessary to guard that liberty. They understood all of these things. And that's why President Jefferson at the time, 1803, said that this was, if the Supreme Court's going to be the final arbiter, the Supreme Court is going to be an oligarchy. So now here's something else that John Marshall had to say. You might be interested to know how John Marshall argued against Jefferson. He said there must be an ultimate arbiter somewhere, and that the Supreme Court, as we've already established, was that final arbiter. That's what we've already seen. Marshall, of course, voiced the feelings of the entire class, attorney class, that we have in America, apparently, because that's what people today are saying. So they tell us whatever the court decides is constitutional. Just take for an example, Obamacare. When Obamacare was passed by Democrat-led Congress and White House, then what? It went to the Supreme Court, and everybody waited with bated breath. What was the Supreme Court going to say? Ladies and gentlemen, it was already unconstitutional. It doesn't make any difference what the Supreme Court had to say on the subject. We'll come back to that in a few moments as well. Whatever the Supreme Court says is constitutional, that's the doctrine. That's the doctrine that most people apparently believe today. But Thomas Jefferson said, no, you have it wrong. The Supreme Court is not the final arbiter. Well, what is? What is the final arbiter? Listen carefully. He said, true, there must be a final arbiter, that is. But does that prove that it is either party, the Supreme Court, or the people? No, he says the ultimate arbiter is the people of the Union. The people of the Union, assembled by their deputies in convention at the call of Congress or by two-thirds of the states. Who are the final arbiters, the final judges of what is constitutional or not? The people. The Constitution begins with we the people. What we have today is, it might be called, judicial supremacy. And I'm asking this question now, what is wrong with judicial supremacy? Let's note 4 points very briefly. What is wrong with judicial supremacy? Number one, the Constitution does not itself erect such a tribunal as the Supreme Court to make the decisions on what is or is not constitutional. Is the Constitution or is the Supreme Court's decisions the law of the land, the ultimate law of the land? This is exactly Jefferson's point. The Constitution has erected no such tribunal. If it is the case, in other words, that the Supreme Court, 9 black-robed judges, are the ones who are going to tell us what is or is not constitutional all the way across the board, then why even have constitution? Why do we carry pocket constitutions? Why do we study constitutions? Why even look at it? Why should anyone be interested in looking at what the Constitution actually says? Let's just let the Supreme Court handle everything for us. You might recognize that is exactly the position regarding the Holy Roman Church, or the Roman Catholic Church, as they call themselves, the Roman Catholic Church. They say, we are the final arbiters of what the Bible actually teaches. The Protestant position says, no, the Bible is written for mankind to read and understand on his own, and we don't need a Holy Roman See to tell us what it does mean. And interestingly enough, the Bible does not include within its pages, between its covers, anything that has to do with the city of Rome or the Holy Roman See, as they call it, as being the final decision maker as to what is scriptural or what is not. We come to the Bible, we can read it, we can understand it. It was written to be understood. So exactly with the Constitution. It was written to be understood, and it does not include within its pages that the Supreme Court should be the final judge. Secondly, think about this. The doctrine of judicial review has been perverted into judicial supremacy. We have really, what we have in our country is and should be constitutional supremacy. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. That's why all the office holders take their oaths upon the Constitution. By the way, should they take, just as we're thinking about it, should they take an oath upon all the decisions of the Supreme Court and all the future decisions that they may reverse, the past decisions that have been made? Well, they would not be able to take an oath on such a thing, would they? No, the truth is the Supreme Court can have a judicial review in the sense that parties coming before a court, whether it be an appellate court or whether it be a circuit court or whether it be the Supreme Court or whatever it may be, parties come before it having a suit. And this suit is decided by the judges on the bench that are to apply the Constitution. And that decision is to apply to the parties only. That is only the disputants in that particular court decision. Here's an example of what I'm talking about. Just take Roe versus Wade in 1973. What happened? Well, the Supreme Court went into the Constitution. They couldn't find what they wanted to find, so they said, well, the Constitution gives a woman the right to murder her unborn child. Where did they find that in the Constitution? Well, it wasn't there. They're already off on the wrong foot, to say the least of it. Then what happened? Now they impose their will upon every single state in the Union. Every single state had to revamp, rechange, and follow the dictates of the Supreme Court. That is wrong. That is all wrong. And we got wrong on it by thinking that the Supreme Court is the final judge. Number three, the Constitution is ultimately a contract drawn up between the people and the representatives, their representatives in the federal government. Since that is the case, two sides in a contract. Let me just ask it this way. If you have a contract on a house, a piece of property, you have a contract in business, both parties have the ability and the right to be able to read and understand and interpret the clauses of that said contract. What would you think if one side said, we only have the right to decide what these clauses actually mean? You have no right, Bill Lockwood, to determine what these clauses mean. And we're going to interpret them for you in every sense of the term. And you have not one right or ability to come in and defend any clause or anything that you think it means. We're going to tell you what it means. You know what? No one would sign a contract like that. I don't think we would. But that's exactly how the Supreme Court and the federal government operates today, because we, the people, have not done our job in maintaining our rights. So, number four, lastly, in finishing this up, the Constitution was ratified. I think this is so interesting. Just think about this for a moment. Remember, we're talking about whether the Supreme Court is the final judge, the ultimate arbiter in what is constitutional, determining what is constitutional and what is not. And that implies that the people cannot understand it, the people don't know what it is, and the people are simply waiting for the Supreme Court to speak that we might know what the Constitution is. Or if that's the case, think for a moment, when was the Constitution ratified? That was 1787, written in 1787, ratified by 88. When was the first Supreme Court organized? Well, that was 1789, and it didn't convene until 1790. And do you know what happened? The people were able to look at the Constitution in all of its statements and all of its commentaries by those who crafted it as they put it in all the newspapers. By the way, our founding fathers didn't have the Nancy Pelosi syndrome idea that is pass it and we'll, and you can find out what's in it later. No, they wanted everyone to know what's in it and what they were buying into before they ratified the Constitution. And the Constitution was ratified by the people acting through the representatives, and that was long before there was a Supreme Court. So how, pray tell, can it be that we have come to a position in America today where the populace seems to believe that we don't know what is the Constitution, what it says, and what it means until a judge speaks? That is wrong-headed to begin with. No, it's a small document, just a few pages, and it is your document. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. Now, before we came on this particular segment, I was talking with Mike about a song of 1988, and we were kind of kicking around. Who was the one who did that? Don't Worry, Be Happy. Bobby, you said it was Bobby?
McFerrin.
McFerrin.
Yeah.
And everybody remembers, or a lot of people remember, Don't Worry, Be Happy. Now,
yeah.
When I read this article, I thought about Bobby McFerrin. I thought he must be now controlling or helping control the United Nations. Now, you may not even, this is hard to believe what you're about to hear. There is now a WHC, I believe it's WHC, at the UN. What is that? It's a World Happiness Council. World Happiness Council. That's what it is. So the World Happiness Council at the United Nations, it's an arm of the United Nations, they have set up a global dialogue for happiness. They want everybody to be happy globally. So the key component is World Government Summit. World Government. You know, they used to avoid that word government. They would say World Governing Summit, but now they're out with it. World Government Summit. And here's how the WGS website introduces the Global Dialogue for Happiness. Happiness is gaining momentum worldwide due to an increasing belief that the real work of government is to create a happy, healthy, and positive society. This year, the World Government Summit will launch its activities with a full-day event dedicated to the advancement of human happiness around the world. The Global Dialogue for Happiness event will bring together top thinkers, decision makers, and experts from around the world to start a global discussion on the importance of happiness and well-being, Mike, and the imperative role of governments in achieving elevated levels of happiness worldwide. Now, there's the last phrase there, see, the imperative role of governments in elevating and achieving and elevating happiness. So there you have it.
What are they going to do? Hand out free narcotics? I mean, what is their plan?
Okay,
exactly?
So here is the plan. I'm glad you asked because here are the plans.
All right.
This actually comes from one man by the name of Alexander Kurulf. I guess is how you say K-J-E-R-U-L-F. He has 11 government policies, and these are promoted by the United Nations to promote happiness at work and give a country a competitive advantage. You know, we are not competitive enough because we're not happy enough. So this is what they're proposing, and they have a lot of money. They have a lot of political clout. Number one, regulate and inspect psychological workplace safety. That would be a global initiative. Oh, now we're seeing it. See, so at a workplace such as a radio station, we're going to have UN inspectors coming in to see your psychological safety to make sure that you're safe here, Mike.
Already, I got this vein in my neck that's about to explode.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So psychologically unsafe workplaces is the cause of low production, apparently. Number two, regulate against permanent overwork. So
what does that even mean?
Well, in Denmark, for example, I think they work something like 30 hours a week, and the government disallows more than that.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting to note the United States government is already in that business. I think if we reach back to the last of the last century, not, well, I didn't word that correctly, but 1890s, I think we'll come to what is called the Lochner decision. And the Lochner decision at the Supreme Court level was that a person working in a bakery, there's a bakery in New York, I believe, and they can only work so many hours a week. Now, if you wanted to come in and work 60 hours a week because I want to make more money and I have bills to pay and I want to work that much, you know, the Constitution tells us in Article 1, Section 10, we have freedom to contract. I can contract that. But in the Lochner decision, they came along and said, no, you cannot do that. You actually, the government disallows an individual from working more than so many hours a week unless you're going to be paid overtime and so forth. And that's what we have already going on in the United States. So the government is already in the freedom, curtailing the freedom business, and that's what's happening here. So they're telling you how many hours you must work. So they're going to come into a workplace and say, you can only work 30 hours a week. And that's just tough. If you need to work more, I guess you go get a part-time job somewhere. So I don't know how this is going to work. But, of course, they'll come in and tell you what you can and can't do on that one also. So, number three, mandate employee representation on boards of directors. Mandate. So the government's, isn't it interesting that it requires more government intrusion into the free marketplace?
Well, you've already twice used the word regulate or regulation.
And now we're using the word mandate.
Mandate. Regulate, mandate. These are very aggressive terms. I think I need my safe space now.
That's right. Well, they might mandate a safe space as well. So that's right. That's going to be a regulating the safe space. Oh. How many hours you can stay in that, apparently. This is an article by John McManus who put this together. It's really, but these points, these are actually the points that the United Nations is recommending. Number four, make government workplaces role models. Ha ha! Make government workplaces role models. So you go to Washington, D.C. to see how you should run your business here.
Like the VA, maybe.
That's right, like the VA.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, so that's going to be your role model.
Hit them with the bedpan.
Number five, promote lifelong learning. Now, that's interesting. That caught my eye because that's exactly what the byline of the Wichita Falls ISD is, you know, promoting lifelong learners. And that's what the United Nations is all about, lifelong learning. Government makes education cheap because it demands everybody pay for it, makes it cheap, and then we're going to have everybody having a bigger chance to get into the education business, supposedly, and it's going to be mandated by the United Nations, not the United States government. Number six, require companies to measure and report on employee happiness. So we're going to have people in the management position, such as yourself, going to write in reports after I walk out of here, and you're going to say, was Lockwood happy?
What's one more report?
What's one more report? Right. That's right. Another report, you're going to talk about how all of the people that you come into contact with are happy, I suppose. Or
this is how unhappy I am already hearing this. This crushed Krugelow, Crumple, whatever his name was over there, I already want to punch him in the throat.
Yeah, he says that you need this happiness council right now. So you need
would make me happy to hit him, actually.
Number seven, require all government suppliers to be certified happy workplaces. You're going to have to see, it's almost like you go to a restaurant and you say, okay, what, you see, they have the rating. A rating, B rating, and the kitchens, you know, how clean it is. Now we're going to have happiness rating. And that's what it's going to be. I imagine we'll have a law that tells you how to publish. This is actually, see, this sounds like a joke, but it's actually United Nations.
I can already see it. They're going to resurrect that old Nickelodeon cartoon, Ren and Stimpy. And you're going to have these big posters of Ren and Stimpy with their little song, Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy, Happy, Happy,
that's
Joy,
right.
Joy.
Number eight, don't hobble trade unions. People want to be happy in a trade. Don't hobble trade unions.
Don't hobble them.
So, yeah, don't hobble them. In other words, in the southern states that have the automobile manufacturers that are not unionized and they're out being outsourced from the north, well, we're going to stop that.
But what if it makes me happy to hobble somebody?
Well, I know I'm getting confused.
They're defeating my happiness already, see?
Number nine, celebrate the best workplaces, the happiest ones. And then number 10, make unemployment benefits widely available and livable. And number 11, make bad workplaces and managers legally responsible for the harm they cause.
Wait a minute, Bill. Hold on. Let's back up.
If you're making people unhappy, this is what you're going to do.
Let's back up to that unemployment thing just a minute.
Okay.
If everybody's happy, and all these companies are compliant, you wouldn't have anyone unemployed. So why would you need the unemployment requirement?
Yeah, you're confusing me, Mike. That's right. But that's right.
I want to hit this guy. Where is it? Where do I find
him? Well, here's another guy that's involved in it, and we've talked about him on the radio before. His name is Jeffrey Sachs. Sachs is S-A-C-H-S. And he wrote a book. I can't remember the name of it. We had it up here, and I did a program regarding it, but it was about his environmental agenda.
Yeah.
But Jeffrey Sachs, who's been a UN guru for many, many years.
Yeah, I know the name.
Yeah. He says this, in sum, the United States offers a vivid portrait of a country that is looking for happiness in all the wrong places. The country is mired in a roiling social crisis that is getting worse. So he tells us he's got a 5-point plan, too. And here's how we're going to go about it. So they're going to step in, and they're going to have mental health. In other words, it gets down to mental health. They're going to have mental health examiners looking at workplaces and seeing who is being pressured and who is not. And that's what it's all about. And it comes from the United Nations.
I say we run the UN out of New York. We take the building over. Let's turn the whole thing into a hog rendering plant. It's already been full of pigs anyway.
Yeah.
So we're not going to make it smell any worse than it already does.
You know what? And you know, that proposal makes me happy. That would be good. That's right.
Happy, so, happy, joy, 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 happy.
So that's why I asked joy, about joy. Bobby McFerrin as we started here. So, all right, let's take a break. We'll be right back with more American Liberty. Welcome back. In this segment, I want to talk for just a few moments about something that I brought up at the very beginning, and that is that this is what we're in, is a cultural war. But really, the culture goes to religious roots. It has religious presuppositions. There's no way to escape, as many people want to do that, to escape it, but there's no way to escape that conclusion, and that is everything that's going on in our nation, everything that's happening, all of the turmoil that we are seeing, is really because we are in, of sorts, a religious war. Well, what do I mean by that? I mean that the paradigm through which I am viewing all that is taking place really is I have a God-centered worldview, and the paradigm through which I'm looking is that particular standard. And what we are seeing is really immorality and ungodliness, what's happening. This poll that I'm about to look at here and share with you is a Gallup poll that just came out. It's telling us that America is becoming more liberal and more immoral. And that's really the facts of the matter. So, for example, the findings are 91% of those surveyed considered birth control to be morally acceptable. 73% think that divorce is okay, compared to 59% of respondents in 2001. That is, from 73%, or from 59, rather, in 2001, up to 73%. When Gallup's Values and Beliefs survey was first conducted, that was 2001, 69% were in favor of sex between an unmarried man and a woman. 2001, the survey said 53%. So from 2001 till today, 53%. Now 69%. 63% approved of same-sex relationships versus 40% in 2001. So get the scale in your mind. 40% of American people in 2001 said same-sex relationships were legitimate, were all right. Now, 63% of Americans. Just stop for a moment and think. This is why it's not simply liberalism or conservatism. Instead, it has to do with moral principle. It has to do with the moral belief system that we have, the value system that is in place. 62%, continuing on with the surveys, 62% approved of having a child outside of wedlock. That was in the recent survey. 62%, 45% in 2001. So in every single category that we've looked at, whether it be sex between unmarried men and women, whether it be same-sex relationships, whether it be children outside of wedlock, abortion, all of those things, everything has gone up. Abortion, however, I might back up and say this. The attitudes have been more or less constant throughout the years, especially since 2001 when the first survey, this is really called the Values and Beliefs Survey by Gallup Poll. 2001, there were 43% approved of abortion. Now, today, 49% of Americans disapprove of abortion, so that has remained pretty much the same. This is also now a 2016 survey by the Southern Baptist Convention's Lifeway Research. It showed 81% of Americans are concerned about declining moral behavior in their country. Do you see why this is not a political fight merely? Oh, it does play out on a political field. And we can see it playing out in Congress, and we can see the wars taking place on the congressional battlefields and at the ballot box. We see all of that. But behind the scenes is a moral belief system. It is a moral code that we're talking about. And according to this survey by the Baptist Church, 81% of Americans are concerned about the moral depravity or the decline in moral behavior in our country. 46% of those in this Baptist survey of the respondents said they strongly agree with the statement, "I am concerned about declining moral behavior in our nation." Only 6% said they strongly disagree, and another 13% said they disagree. I don't know where the 6 and the 13% people are, but the writing is absolutely on the wall, and that is America is becoming an immoral nation. Lifeway Research Executive Director is Scott McConnell. He said the survey suggests that we are shifting very fast from a world where right and wrong didn't change to a world where right and wrong are relative. We are not all on the same page when it comes to morality, and we have not reckoned with what that means. That is exactly the point that I have been making on this program over the last months and number of years, and that is we are in a spiritual warfare. That's what the Bible teaches, and that is exactly how it is playing out in America today. I want to remind you that John Adams, the second president of the United States, said this, that our Constitution is made only for a moral and religious people. And by the way, when he said religion, he meant Christian religion. A moral and religious people. It is wholly unfit for any other. Why might be that the case? Why would John Adams make such a statement? The reason is because if people become immoral and their behavior is astray outside the boundaries of what is understood as proper behavior, then you cannot legislate, pass, and enforce enough laws to control the populace. You cannot do it. It cannot be done. That explains a little bit, doesn't it, as to why it is the case that we see so much legislation being pumped out of Washington. Not only is it the case that they perhaps love to do it, but it is also the case that as we become immoral, as our behavior declines, and we slouch towards Gomorrah, to borrow the title of Robert Bork's book, Slouching Towards Gomorrah, as we slouch as a nation towards Gomorrah, we cannot come up with enough laws to control the behavior of the people. Ladies and gentlemen, there are only two controls that we can have, and that is you put one of them in your heart. That is the principles of God, God-given principles, and you place them in your heart and you live by that code and you control your behavior, or you're going to have to be controlled by outside forces, something outside your body. I tell this to students all the time. You're either going to control yourself or someone's going to have to control you. This is why we have a burgeoning population in the prison system. This is why we have out-of-control behavior on the streets. We have out-of-control behavior on the college campuses, because we have become a morally depraved nation. Therefore, the remedy for America is not more legislation. The remedy is not simply to curtail some of the onerous laws that have come down the pike. The remedy is turning our hearts to God and implementing the moral code that He gave us and putting it in our hearts. And if we cannot do that, then we are bound to be controlled by a totalitarian government of dictators. And the short reprieve that we are now seeing with Donald Trump that is rolling back the government is only that, a short reprieve. And we'll go right back to a totalitarian-style government. Speaking of moral depravity and ungodliness, have you read this about the University of Chicago? The students are issuing racially charged demands to the officials. This kind of goes back to what we remember from the 1960s, or what we remember reading about the 1960s, in which the hippie generation, they took over some of the administration buildings on college campuses, and they held hostage some of the administrators. And then the college presidents and the superintendents of different universities, they would come in and they would have sit-downs with all of these students. Instead of demanding that they behave properly and lawfully, instead they came down and they caved in on almost every single occasion. This is exactly what's continuing to come on. This is the University of Chicago. There's a coalition of multicultural student groups known as U Chicago United. U Chicago United. U is simply the letter U. It presented a list of demands to the University of Chicago on May 19th that the group claims will serve as the launch of a long-term campaign fight for marginalized students. The coalition contends that campus climate in general fails to adequately support students of marginalized backgrounds and identities. And to address these concerns, U Chicago United presented their demands at a campus rally May 19th. And here are the speakers, or some of the groups that had speakers at the platform. There were approximately 40 students were in attendance. 40, that's only 40. The rally featured speakers from numerous organizations, including a movement was called MECA, which is a movement of Mexicans for the state of Aztlan. Aztlan is, of course, what they call the Southwest, and they say that it belongs to them. DU Chicago. So it is a MECA organization. Organization of Black Students, the OBS. Pan-Asia Solidarity Coalition. Muslim Students Association. Arab Students Association. African Caribbean Students Association. And Organization of Latin American Students. Now listen to the list of demands. This is the university. They said, the demands, as I said, of university-funded and run cultural houses, specifically a Black house, Latinx, a new gender-neutral alternative to Latino-Latina house, and an Asian house. The list also demands the school's core curriculum include a new diversity and inclusion graduation requirement that would primarily focus on U.S.-centric structural oppression, such as race, gender, and sexuality. All of this means simply is that in order to pass the University of Chicago and in order to get a degree, you're going to have a degree or at least some studies in diversity and inclusion, and find out about how bad and how hateful America has been in the past, how we have been racist, and how we have had oppression of genders and sexualities in the past, and we need to continue to correct it by all of these different organizations. This is such atrocities taking place. This is what happens when you empty a culture of its moral content. People just absolutely go haywire, and we are seeing that on the campuses everywhere. We'll be back. Welcome back. In the few moments that we have remaining, I want to talk about one great positive thing that has just been occurring. And there are a lot of positive things in the Trump administration. Here's a man who is rolling back the government, rolling back this monstrosity, this out-of-control government, and going back toward the Constitution, which is, of course, limited government. Anything that is for limited government, we are in favor of. This happens to be regarding the WOTUS rule, the waters of the United States. And before we came on today, Mike was briefing me on a little bit of it, but I want to say one word about the background of it. The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has, since its inception, I believe that was 1972, has been seeking to expand its powers in one decision or one writing or one brief after another, and they have done that. Even though they have been slapped down by the United States Supreme Court upon several occasions, and one of which was, if I'm not mistaken, the Rapinoe decision, which occurred in 2006. But after that decision came down, then the EPA came out with the Waters of the United States rule, and that is that everything is connected. So they had what was called the connectivity theory. Everything is connected. So even the water in a cow track is connected to the waters that finally goes into the streams, into the oceans. Therefore, the EPA has control over it. But now, here's the good news, and that is...
Well, Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, has announced that they are suspending implementation of WOTUS.
Boy, that is good news.
Yeah, we're getting totally out of this. They recognize what a disastrous effect this will have on American agriculture, on American industry. I mean, you're talking about a restriction that would make it difficult for you to even capture water on your own property, as in a tank or a pond for your cattle or your livestock. I mean, we're talking about a rule that would make it that would put even your stock ponds under control of the EPA. And I felt like this was one of those regulations that they would get us out of. They took a little longer doing it than I thought they would, but
it was accomplished.
It's been accomplished. So
yeah.
You know, you got to admit, folks, Donald Trump is living up.
He is doing exactly what he said he was going to do.
To a lot of the claims he's made. Now, you know, we're still dragging our feet on things like Obamacare and the border situation. We're running into roadblocks at every turn on that. I think we'll overcome it. But this is one of those things. This is one of those draconian, idiotic rules that Obama cooked up and that the EPA cooked up under the Obama administration that is now going to be done away with. Thank you, Lord.
You know, I have Scott Pruitt's, of course, former in Oklahoma representative, and he made the statement, "We are taking significant action to return power to the states and provide regulatory certainty to our nation's farmers and businesses."
Right.
This is the first step in the two-step process to redefine waters of the United States, and we are committed to moving through this reevaluation to quickly provide regulatory certainty in a way that is thoughtful, transparent, and collaborative with other agencies and the public. What is wrong with that, people? Return power to the states. Isn't that what we should be about? That's exactly right.
Precisely.
Exactly. You know what? I am so thankful for that, because that is one of those EPA rules that I have decried, as well as simply the existence of the EPA, to be sure, but nevertheless, a good step. If you're in Wichita Falls, the radio station is KWFS. It's News Talk 1290, newstalk1290.com. In Lubbock, it's KFYO. It's News Talk 790. It's KFYO.com. And in Abilene, it's KYYW 1470. That's 1470, KYYW.com. You can find everything here at American Liberty with BillLockwood.com. We thank you today for listening. In just a moment.